It's time now for the Lamb McElhaney Legal Show. Each show, heard every other Thursday at 12:30, will feature different lawyers and their guests from the law firm of Lamb McElhaney. And now today's show host, Guy Donatelli and Mary Ellen Allen, are partners and co-chairs of the Employment Law Department at Lamb McElhaney Professional Corporation. They'll be discussing employment agreements, handbooks, and policies, as well as separation agreements and other areas of employment law. And now here's Guy Donatelli and Mary Ellen Allen.
Good afternoon. This is Mary Ellen Allen. I'm here with my law partner, Guy Donatelli, and we're attorneys at the law firm of Lamb McElhaney. Lamb McElhaney is located here in Westchester. We have about 35 attorneys, and we also have offices located in Bryn Mawr as well as Philadelphia.
Mary Ellen and I are co-chairs of the Lamb McElhaney Employment Law Group. And as you'll see in the next half an hour, the practice of employment law is a very broad area. We address things such as public and private employment, both for employers and employees. We do some HR consulting. We review employment handbooks and employment agreements and policies, and also review items that take us into court sometimes, Mary Ellen, such as
discrimination, statutory protections under the law, contractual rights, unemployment, restrictive covenants like non-competes, non-solicitation agreements, and of course, today's topic, separation agreements.
That's right. So what is a separation agreement? And we're sort of leapfrogging into the end of the employment relationship, but a separation agreement is a document which formalizes the termination of an employee's employment from his or her employer. Generally, it's a written document. It spells out all of the rights and obligations of the parties to that agreement so that after the event, there's no lingering doubts as to what the relationship is or what the scope of authority is, or whether and to what extent the employee is entitled to additional compensation, or whether the employer is obligated to do anything further in the relationship.
Exactly, guys. So it lays out all of the post-employment obligations, both for the employer and the employee. So they usually arise, of course, when an employee is terminated involuntarily. It's not too common to see a severance agreement with an employee that's resigned, although that does come up in some situations. But usually it's an employee that's being asked to leave the company, and the employer and the employee would like to enter into an agreement for multiple reasons. Of course, on the employer side, they would like to see a full release of all claims, meaning that this employee cannot leave and then come back and sue their employer for some reason. And of course, the employee would like to see additional compensation to help bridge the gap between termination and their next employment adventure.
Mary Ellen makes a good point when she suggests that these sorts of agreements arise out of a termination of an employee. And whether and to what extent a separation agreement is a driving factor in ending the relationship depends a lot on whether you're an at-will employee or whether you have a contract with the employer. You don't have a general right to severance. There's no law that says an employer must pay an employee severance in the event that that employee is terminated. Now, there is an exception to that, and that's if you're an employer who signs a contract with an employee for a specific period of time, and that contract may contain post-termination rights or payments, such as paying that employee through the end of the contractual period. So if you go to work for someone for 2 years and they terminate you without cause in year one, you can expect, in my view, to be able to negotiate a severance, which is at least a year, because that's the remainder on your contract. But there's no general right outside of a contract or a specific policy that an employer may have to pay severance?
That's a question, Guy, that I have received from employees. I've received calls from employees who ask, under the law, what am I entitled to in terms of severance? Usually those are employees that have worked either in Europe or in Canada, because in various countries, severance is required, and there is no such thing as at-will employment, where the employee can just be terminated without giving any type of severance payment. But here in the U.S., that's not the case, and particularly, obviously, we're talking about Pennsylvania.
That's a great point. And there are certain things that we advise both employees and employers to look for to see whether a severance arrangement needs to be addressed. So we'll give you an example. If you're an employer who has a policy that says we will pay severance in the amount of 1 week for every year that you're employed,
right,
an employee might be able to make the argument that that rises to the level of a contractual obligation and that severance must be paid. There are also severance plans that certain employers have that an employee can take advantage of, and it's useful for both the employee and the employer to know what those rights are as they're approaching what I say that Friday afternoon, when that's when you usually hear as an employee towards the end of the day on a Friday.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about, Guy, an actual severance agreement, and what are the terms, you know, that we normally see included, that we normally include. You and I have both drafted severance agreements on behalf of employers. We have reviewed and negotiated severance agreements on behalf of employees as well. So you and I are both very familiar with what terms need to be included, of course, in the severance agreement. And the first term that's usually included, of course, is compensation.
Right. And Mary Ellen, would you say that there is a recipe for these types of agreements? Yeah.
Absolutely. There's essential terms that I want to see in any severance agreement. There certainly can be other optional terms that are included at the request of either the employee or the employer. But there are essential terms that need to be included.
You hit the nail right on the head. The primary reason, at least from an employee's perspective, is so that he or she knows exactly what he or she can expect going forward. And compensation is, I would say, that's number one.
That's number one.
So there is no standard. People will say to you, well, you should get them a week for every month or a week for every year, or
right.
there's no such legal imperative. There's no such legal reason for that. There are rules of thumb, and there are experiences which we all have. Employment relationships are changing, but just because you're a 20-year employee doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get 20 weeks. I would argue that you should get more if I was representing the employee. However, you want to make sure that that employment agreement identifies how much you're going to be paid going forward, whether it's going to be paid during the regular paycheck intervals. In other words, is it going to be every 2 weeks or every month for that period of time, or whether you're going to get a lump sum payment. So item number one is identify how much you're going to receive as compensation under the severance agreement. And I say compensation because we'll talk a little later about what value to the employer paying a severance agreement gives the employer, and we'll get there. But you're actually, as an employee, giving up some very significant rights. So when you pick up your severance agreement, you want to make sure that you're being adequately compensated for what you're giving up.
And of course, you know, if push comes to shove and the severance agreement ends up in a legal battle in court, any court is going to want to see that the employee received adequate compensation for the release, for giving up those rights. There has to be adequate compensation, of course, for the employee. And as we were just talking about, what is adequate ties into how long have you been there, what is your regular salary, you know, what is your position with the company, and what are the terms, of course, of the termination, meaning what was the reason for the termination. All of that will factor into the amount that's offered by an employer for severance, unless, of course, there's one of those plans we talked about earlier,
right,
which lays it all out. or if the employee had an employment agreement up front at the beginning, which said, if you're terminated for X reasons, this is the amount of severance that you'll receive.
And let's talk about perhaps something we've talked over, the reason for the termination. If you are an employee, you're going to want to make sure that the language of the severance agreement is neutral.
Neutral.
So that, and the employer, I would imagine, and when we represent employers, we look for this as well. You want a neutral reason that the parties have decided to separate and leave it at that. There's no reason to suggest that it's a for-cause termination or a quit or a resignation, because that might have an impact down the road when the employee applies for unemployment compensation, because that's got to be factored in at some point. So when you are looking at your severance agreement, keep in mind, why am I leaving? Why is the relationship ending?
And I agree with you, Guy. It should be neutral. There's no reason to include the reasons for termination in a severance agreement in order to make it valid. It's just not an essential term.
Now, closely related to compensation, you know, your pay, all of us have very similar benefits when it comes to our employment. We have medical benefits, health benefits. We have vacation rights, accrued vacation. Some of us will spend money for our employer, and we expect to be reimbursed for that. And all of those items need to be factored into the agreement as well. So if you're getting a six-month severance arrangement as far as compensation is concerned, you want to marry that, if you can, with the amount of time that your health benefits are going to remain in effect.
Right. So they may not be able to stay on the company plan, so to speak. That's when COBRA benefits would kick in. But it's very common to see in a severance agreement the employer reimburse that employee or just pay upfront the costs associated with those COBRA benefits.
Correct. And COBRA benefits are those benefits that are mandated that allow you to pay a premium. This is going to be a very general overview. Allow you to pay a premium to remain on the group plan that your employer has by paying that portion of the premium that provides coverage for you. So let's say that's $900 a month. Part of the severance arrangement might be a provision which grosses up a payment so that when you pay that $900, it is part of the compensation you're receiving, but it allows you to maintain your health benefits, which is particularly important, I think, sometimes almost more important.
I agree. I think sometimes employees, they'll forego some of the actual compensation in exchange for additional coverage.
That's right.
Or payment for additional coverage.
And don't forget, accrued vacation. I mean, there's my experience is that folks work real hard, and sometimes they neglect to take their time off, conscientious employees, and you're entitled to that. So make sure there's a specific provision in there which says I've got accrued vacation of so many weeks, and I'd like to be paid for that as well.
Right. And, of course, the exception being that if an employer has a policy that says we don't pay that upon termination for any reason, then that would be the exception. But I completely agree, Guy. That's something that needs to be addressed when an employee and an employer are negotiating a severance agreement.
I have found that it has been my experience that employers want to do the right thing when it comes to these types of arrangements because it provides them certainty. And I think the next topic that we're going to discuss is going to be what the employer receives in exchange for compensating the employee under the severance arrangement.
Good afternoon, and now we're back. So when we left off, we were just about to start the topic of the release. So the release is a material term in any severance agreement, and it's what is probably most important to the employer, and it's the most important that an employee completely understand and appreciate what is in a release, because a release, a general release, is very broad, and it is usually a general release that is included in a severance agreement, and the employee may be giving up significant rights. Usually in any severance agreement, an employee is agreeing, I do not have a claim against the employer for any reason, discrimination or otherwise, and if I do, I'm willing to give up the right to pursue that in exchange for the compensation that I'm receiving in the severance agreement. So it's very important that an employee take the time to go through that portion of the severance agreement with his or her attorney, because it has wide-ranging effects.
That's right. And this is... this is the way the deal is struck. An employer is paying the employee additional compensation, not their last 2 weeks. You know, some employers pay at the end of a 2 week period. This is consideration. This is payment for something. And what he's getting, what she's getting, is some certainty that the employee is not going to sue the company or the employer. And the release provides that protection to the employer. That's part of the negotiation, because if you believe as an employee that you have been subjected to a wrong in some way, whether it's a constitutionally protected right or some other form of bad treatment that you may have a cause of action for, you may go see a lawyer about that, you're going to want to negotiate hard. And the employer is going to want to make sure that that release is airtight, so that when you ultimately sign on the dotted line, both of the parties go on their way with a clear understanding of what's in store for both of them. Sometimes the amount of the severance payment is dependent on the strength of a perceived claim that an employee might have against an employer. And that's where the attorney comes in. A lot of attorneys will see you and will listen to you without cost, without charge, and give you some advice as to whether you have a claim, whether you have a strong negotiating position, or whether you don't. And usually these severance agreements, it has been my experience, are ones that are negotiated in a context where older workers lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. And this may be hard to hear for someone my age. I'm 60. But an older worker is somebody who's 40 years or older. And you have rights under federal law if you're terminated, if you're 40 years old. And you're giving those up if you sign one of these severance arrangements. So you want to make sure that you explore why you're being released and what evidence can you give the lawyer to establish a stronger negotiating position.
Right, which ties into the amount of time an employee has to consider a release. There are requirements there. In order to make that release effective, the employee has to be given an adequate amount of time to review it. Now, for older workers, like you were just talking about, the requirement is 21 days. So from the time an employee is handed a severance agreement until the day they have to sign it and bring it back, the period is 21 days. Now, an employee can waive that. They don't have to wait that long. A lot of employees do want to waive that, so the sooner they sign the agreement, then the sooner the severance payments will start. But after that period, once they sign, there's also a 7-day revocation period. The employee has 7 days to change his or her mind and say, you know what, I've decided I don't want to go through with this severance agreement. I'm not giving up my rights, and therefore I understand I won't receive the payments. And that 7-day period, that the employee has to change his or her mind, cannot be waived. And so the agreement is not effective until the 8th day after that revocation period ends.
And that may sound like a lot of jargon, but you have to understand the context in which that law was passed. Before that law was passed, providers for a household would be brought into a room. They would be given an agreement. That person would be told to sign it And if he or she didn't sign it, they wouldn't get anything. And the first thing in that person's mind is, how am I going to make my mortgage payment? How am I going to feed my kids? So they sign it, and they take a lot less than they would have otherwise been entitled to. And the law said, no, we have to provide protection from those people so they're not ambushed mm-hmm. on a Friday afternoon with a disadvantageous agreement. So the federal law will protect those folks who are older workers and who may believe that they're being terminated or passed over because of their age.
So, Guy, another term that we should touch on today, well, two terms, really, and a lot of times they're melded into one paragraph, is confidentiality and non-disparagement. So confidentiality will apply to the agreement itself. Most employers and employees will want to see the terms of the agreement be kept confidential. The employer has an interest in doing that for a number of reasons, one of which is if there's no set amount of severance that's offered to employees, they don't want other employees to know what amount that employer has come up with for this particular employee, because then the next employee who's terminated will walk in and say, well, I know so-and-so got this amount. Why don't I get that amount as well? And if they're case-by-case, fact-specific, that's why the employer would want to keep that the terms of the severance agreement, of course, confidential. And the other piece of that is the non-disparagement clause.
Which I've quite frankly, and I'll be honest with everyone out there, I've often wondered what non-disparagement is. The clause usually says something like neither party will disparage the other.
Right.
Well,
what does that mean exactly?
What does that mean exactly?
Push comes to shove and someone's accusing the other party of disparaging them. What does that mean? I try to define it when I'm doing severance agreements, you know, anything that would damage the professional reputation or could damage the professional reputation of either the employer or the employee. You know, something along those lines to give it a little bit more clarification.
And that's good advice. What you'll see in a lot of cases, and I know that Mary Ellen and I do this, is, you know, the purpose, again, of this agreement is to put a period at the end of the employment relationship. It's over. So you will script. I often advise or try to negotiate with other lawyers a joint statement.
Mm-hmm. I've done that as well.
So that we don't have to worry about tripping over an inadvertent comment. My employer and I, after 20 years, decided to part company, and I'm looking forward to my next adventure, something like that. And with respect to non-disparagement, I just say, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything.
Right.
And often it's difficult, and this is where counseling with attorneys can help, and with your spouse, because a lot of times, almost in every instance, The language allows you to discuss your severance contract with your lawyer, with your accountant,
right,
with your financial planner, and with your spouse. And a lot of times, you know, I know I've been with Mary Ellen and I have been partners for 20 years. We will talk after hours. And so you just want to counsel, and you just want to be aware that if you can't say something nice,
right,
you shouldn't say anything at all.
I completely agree. Better to err on the side of caution for both parties. Like you said, it's over.
It's
everyone
over.
Should part ways, go their separate ways.
As I like to say, never darken my doorway again.
So, Guy, the next part of a severance agreement that is included sometimes and sometimes it's not are restrictive covenants. And by that, I mean a non-competition agreement or a non-solicitation provision. So sometimes those are the employee is already subject to those. They've signed something at the beginning of their employment which says they won't solicit clients for a certain period of time if they leave, or they won't go to a competing company for a certain period of time. And the severance agreement should address, okay, is that agreement going to remain in effect? Is the employee still going to be bound by those restrictive covenants, or is the employer willing to waive those? And that can become part of the negotiation.
That's right. And that's where language is very important. If you sign a severance agreement and there's a clause in it that says this agreement memorializes all agreements between the parties and supersedes all prior agreements, and you're the employer, and you have a non-compete with that employee, you're giving up a very valuable right. And if you're an employee, that has a prior contract with the employer that provides you certain benefits that are not concluded, not included in the severance arrangement, you're going to lose those unless you specifically cull them out and draft them into that agreement. So it's important to understand your work history, the documents that you signed, and their significance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say that you never by signing a severance arrangement would give up your rights under a defined benefits pension plan like a 401k or something like that, because those are done through a different mechanism. But if you're an employee with an ESOP, which is an employee stock option plan, and that is contractually based, and you want to make sure that you're not inadvertently giving that up by signing a waiver or a release, because those releases are fairly broad. I will also say that a lot of my clients say, will I be able to collect unemployment compensation? Or some of my other clients would say a different way, what happens if the employee files for unemployment comp? And I view severance arrangements and unemployment compensation to be separate. I don't believe that an employee can give up his or her right to unemployment compensation through a severance arrangement. I think it's got to be a lot more intricate than that.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the unemployment comp agency, of course, that makes the determination whether or not an employee is eligible for unemployment compensation benefits. Usually, severance payments will act as a set-off. There is a formula that the unemployment comp agency uses. So the severance agreement will maybe affect the amounts or when unemployment comp benefits can start, but that's not something that an employee waives in the severance agreement. I have seen severance agreements where an employer will agree not to oppose an employee's request for unemployment compensation, and of course that agreement makes it clear that it's the unemployment comp agency that makes that determination, not the employer, but the employer can agree, I'm not going to do anything or fill out the form in such a way that would oppose your request for unemployment compensation.
Well said. Let's, Mary Ellen, if we can, there are random concepts that arise. And we'll go to a lightning round, with all due respect to Jim Cramer. What about references? And we've talked about non-disparagement clauses, mm-hmm. but how would employers and employees approach a reference? Because in most of these situations, we're not talking about early retirement. We're talking about a termination where the employee wants to go back into the workforce, and that's really the goal. How would you advise that references be handled?
I like to see neutral references, and I think that's to the benefit of both the employee and then the employer. And by neutral reference, Guy, I mean just to verify the dates of the employment, the position that was held, and basically that's it. So nothing more than a neutral reference.
How about clearing out your desk and turning in the keys?
Turning in the keys is essential, and it needs to be done immediately. Don't hold on. Employees should not hold on to any of the employer's property. It all goes back to the employer. So I think we're just about out of time. I hope that everyone has enjoyed the show. This is for educational purposes only and is not intended to be legal advice. But if you do need legal advice, Lam McAlerlane is at 610-430-8000. And our website is lammcalerlane.com.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Lam McAlerlane Legal Show, heard every other Thursday at 12:30 on WCHE 1520, the talk of Chester County.